Basically, do all Jews have obsessive compulsive disorder? Right? I mean, is
the ones you
is Judaism something which is like a? I mean, it's nitpicking and hair splitting, and pays so much attention to details. It is very difficult to understand what is the purpose of the whole thing. I mean, so, halacha, Jewish law, has so many details; it is overwhelming to some people. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, what's the goal of all these 613 commandments? Now, do not get worried, because no one is obligated in 613, unless you are male and female, singled and married and divorced, Kohen Levi Yisrael, all simultaneously. I've spoken to people like that in California, but for the vast majority of us, we're not obligated in all 613. Okay, so but the question I had to ask is, what's the goal of these commandments, number one? And number two, why the attention to detail? How does that fit in or advance the goal of the commandments? Questions are clear? Good. Fine. So let me start with the goal of the commandments. Aside from the fact that God commands them, and he has a moral authority to do so, right, but there are other ideas behind the commandments. First of all, there is a famous story in the Talmud. Turnus Rufus, who was a Roman, came to Rabbi Akiva to ask him a question. And the question he asked Rabbi Akiva, did I speak about this last time? Don't remember. No? No. So he came to ask Rabbi Akiva the following question. If he was asking, which is better, the deeds of God or the deeds of the human being? He figured whichever way Rabbi Akiva answers, I'm going to get him. Because if he says the deeds of God are superior, he's then going to ask, then how could you change anything in the world? How do you have the chutzpah to change anything in this world? And he says, if he's going to tell me the deeds of man are superior, I'm going to say, you're a heretic. So he's totally confident. Totally confident. So Turnus Rufus comes over to Rabbi Akiva, and he says, hey, Rabbi Akiva, what's the better? I don't know if the ancient Romans had Italian accents or not. But my guess is, yeah, probably. You know, like I imagine Caesar is like a Tony Soprano type. He's sitting there, you know, you got problems with the Visigoths. Come and see the Roman Empire. We'll take care of it. So anyway, so Turnus Rufus comes over to Rabbi Akiva and he says, hey, Rabbi Akiva, what's the better, the deeds of a god or the deeds of a man? Okay, so Rabbi Akiva does not answer. He says, just a second, mate. He goes to the fridge and he comes back with a stalk of wheat in one hand and a three-layer chocolate mousse cake in the other. White chocolate, dark chocolate, milk chocolate with some little curled shavings of Cadbury's on top, and maraschino cherries, dulce de leche, and nutmeg just to garnish around the side of the plate. Yeah, okay, I'm all right. Anyway, so he comes in with the chocolate mousse cake and the stalk of wheat, and he tells Turnus Rufus, you tell me, what's better? Deeds of God? Weighs around the stalk of wheat. Deeds of man? Weighs around the chocolate mousse cake. What was Rabbi Akiva trying to teach us? Well, clearly, the chocolate mousse cake is much better than the wheat. Okay. But even if you're a total health food nut, I mean, you're not going to tell me that the wheat tastes better than the. I mean, even if you're a total vegan whack job, right? And no offense to any whack jobs here, you don't actually take the wheat and go like that, delicious, right? I mean, you cannot eat wheat like that. You have to make it has to go through many many steps in order to process it into something edible, right? In other words, what Rabbi Akiva is saying is the world is like wheat, and wheat is like the world, meaning God did not create the world finished. He did not create the perfect world. He created the world that needs to be perfected. He did not create the human perfect. He created the human as someone who needs to be perfected. He did not create the wheat as a cake. He created the wheat as something which needs to be changed and perfected and turned into bread. You ever wondered, by the way, who invented bread? Anyone? What happened? Caveman Thag walks out of his cave one day. Whistling hadn't evolved yet, right? So he's walking out and he sees some wild wheat and he says to his wife, he says, hey Wilma, he says, check out this wheat. I bet if you cut it down with a knife, right, took the stalks and whacked them with a stick and then took little seeds and then crushed them between some rocks and turned it into a powder-like substance and then poured water into it so it turns into a mud-like paste and then left it and let it rot for a little bit so it produces carbon dioxide gas and inflates and then chuck it into the fire, it should taste fantastic. And it actually does. Right? It's a very strange thing. But in any case, right, so bread, right, is symbolic of the finished product. The human being starts off as wheat and is supposed to turn into chocolate mousse cake in that sense. We need to be perfected. In what ways? There are three areas where we need refinement. Three areas. What are the three areas of refinement? I'd say they're all in the area of awareness and relationship. There is relationship to others, relationship to God, and relationship to self. Okay, three areas. So I'm having this deja vu that I spoke here last time about this. Did I not? What did I speak about last time? No one remembers, probably. Okay.
I wasn't here.
What? Oh, okay.
It was about free will.
Oh, free will. Right. Okay. So anyway, so there's three areas where we need refinement. Three areas. Area number one, relationship to others. Why do we need that? Because a little baby, right, a little kid, doesn't really look at you as another person. They look at you as this object, right, who occasionally they need, right, but basically they don't think of you in terms of your needs, your wants, your desires, your personality. It's just like you're there, you're these lumps in the background type of, you know. Every now and again they hear these like, wow, 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 some adult, who cares, right? But that's what an infant is, right? Like a little baby, like my six-year-old, I mean, he's not seven, but when he was three, I still remember he was three, it's not that long ago, three years old, he'd wake up in the middle of the night, 3 a.m. Abba! I said, what do you want? Right? And he says, I'm thirsty. So I said, who the heck is thirsty at 3 a.m? Alcoholics and little babies, basically, right? So he says, I'm thirsty. I said, fine. So I get him a glass of water. I bring in the glass of water. He drinks an amount of water that is about one molecule. You need scientific instruments to measure how little water he drinks. Right? I feel like saying, I brought you water at 3 a.m. You drink the whole cup. Right, but I don't do that because then I'll have to come back and change the sheets like an hour later. So, okay. So at that age, he doesn't yet realize, he doesn't think of, oh, Abba's tired. Why should I schlep him out of bed at 3 a.m? He doesn't think in those terms, right? Now, as you mature, you become more aware of other people as people. You become more, not everyone, right? There are a lot of people, they grow up to be adults and they are still not aware of other people's existence. Many of them drive on the roads in New York and New Jersey, right? Completely unaware that you exist. Completely unaware, right? And if you do exist, they don't look at you as a person, they look at you as competition on the road, right? And if it's merge or die, they'd prefer you die than merge, right? That's pretty standard in America, right? So anyway, So the first area of refinement is to become more aware of other people. I mean, obviously, as you grow older, mature, if my 19-year-old will wake up in the middle of the night and say, Abba, and I say, what do you want? He says, I'm thirsty. I say, get the beer yourself. Leave me alone, buddy. Right? So obviously, the first area is awareness of others. Second is awareness of self. What do I mean by self? Because a lot of people, when they think of themselves, what do they think of? The physical self. Someone says, I want. When they say, I want, what they usually mean is a particular set of nerve endings needs to be stimulated, right? Whatever that nerve ending is, but it needs to be stimulated in some way, food, whatever it is, right? But that's basically the I. And as long as I have enough of that stimulation, I have enough beer and pizza and television, I'm fine. What else is there, right? And a nice car and a nice house, whatever, right? But basically, they don't think of the I as including also the soul, the spiritual. So another level of awareness is to become more aware that the self includes the neshama, the soul, and the spiritual side, the intellectual side, etc. And third, there's the awareness of God, relationship with God, with the Creator, which people need, and people have this need to transcend beyond mere existence, right? Not everyone. I mean, dogs don't. Dogs are very happy just to lie there on the carpet for the rest of their lives, and as long as they get food and water and a walk every now and again, they're okay. That's it. Humans are not like that. We sit there wondering why, right? What am I here for, etc. Hopefully we wonder that. And if we start to wonder that, what happens? So what do we do in the West if we start to wonder about things like that? We turn up the volume on the iPod. So God forbid we shouldn't think too much, right? And if the iPod's not enough, then we have to get a big screen HD TV so that it floods our senses completely, so chas v'sholom, we should actually think for a moment, right? And then if that doesn't work, then we have to get speakers in the car that are so loud it destroys neurons in the brain, so that basically if I sit and listen to Snoop Doggy Dogg enough at 2000 watts, I won't have frontal lobes left, right? So I won't be able to think. All I'll be able to do is do this. That's basically it, right? So if God forbid, Right, all electronics would cease functioning in America for one day. People would go out of their minds. People would go insane. They'd commit suicide. It's unbelievable. They'd be walking along and saying, why am I here? Like, what is life about? Right, you can't think about things like that. So the third area is awareness of God, right, and awareness of that relationship with God. So I've got three areas of refinement. Number one, relationship to others. Number two, relationship to self. Number three, relationship to God. These are, of course, what it says. You're probably familiar with this. In Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, what does it say in the second Mishnah, first chapter? It says the world stands on three things. The world stands on Torah, study of Torah, Avodah, service of God, Gemilut Chasadim, kindness to others. That is to say, Torah, study of Torah, is relationship to self and your soul. Avodah, service of God, worship, is relationship to God. Gemilut Chasadim, kindness, is relationship to others. So that's the basic three ideas, relationship to God, self, others. Okay. Now, secondly, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel said, this is a very strange statement. He says the following: a person should not say, I can't stand meat and milk. They should say, I'd like it, but God said not to. What does that mean? Well, background. The Torah says you're not allowed to have pepperoni pizza, Philadelphia cheesesteak, veal parmesan, etc. Chicken Kiev, that's the rabbinic, but you're not allowed to have that. Now, the Torah doesn't say this explicitly, but it says no meat and milk. Okay, so now, what should one's at it? Rav Shimon Gamliel says, a person should not say, I can't stand meat and milk. They should say, I'd like it, but I don't have it because God said not to. What does Rav Shimon ben Gamliel mean? So I think the answer is, I figured this out when I read to my children when we lived in Jerusalem, I read to them for the first time one of the great works of English literature, you've probably heard of it, Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss. Anyone read this? In America, you probably study it in college in English literature, my guess is. Right, anyway, so it's called Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss. So I open up the book and I read, Green Eggs and Ham. What are my kids' first questions? First question the kids ask.
What's ham?
What's ham? Interestingly enough, my kids never ask me what green eggs are. You know, that's fine. For a child, green eggs, no problem. That's right. That's either because of some bizarre component of child psychology or because of the school cafeteria. I'm not sure which, right? So anyway, they don't ask me what green eggs are. They ask me what is ham. So I say, ham is the meat of a pig. What do you think my kids' first reaction is? Ugh! They know what a pig is. They say, ugh! I say, it's not ugh. They say, we don't eat it. I say, we eat broccoli. They say, yes, good point. Right? So I point out to them, they say, well, why don't we eat it? Is it not healthy? I say, what do you mean? China, one of the main parts of their diet is pork. There are more Chinese born every year than there are Jews in the world. So it doesn't look as though it's doing too badly for them health-wise. You know what I mean? There's not like swaths of Zhetsuan province being wiped out by trichinosis plagues. Right? They seem to be fine. Right? So it's nothing to do with health. What is it? They say, so I say, you know, I tell them, look, ultimately, I don't absolutely know for sure. But Hashem told us not to eat it. Now, what my point here is the following. I could teach them that it tastes disgusting and that it's unhealthy. But then, would I be training them to exercise free will? Or would I be training them just to be instinctive? I think the answer is I'd be training them just to be instinctive. Right, because you see, free will is central, as we discussed last time. Free will is central to the being a human being, to being human. So that means when I choose something, if the reason I don't eat it is because I look at it and, you know, my father trained me to believe it's disgusting. So when I see it, I say, ugh, disgusting. That's not thinking. That's actually not even a free will decision. That's just instinctive and intuitive, and it also happens to be wrong. So, therefore, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel is telling us that one of the purposes of the commandments is to train us to exercise our free will. In other words, if I believe something tastes disgusting and therefore I don't eat it, does that show self-control? Of course not. Self-control is when this thing looks awesome and it smells awesome and someone tells me it tastes great and it looks good and then I don't have it. That is self-control. But it's not self-control if I convince the kids that the pig is disgusting and that's why we don't eat it. Is this making myself clear? Yeah, okay. So the second idea is what we call free will, or rather thinking versus instinct. Number three, Maimonides says, is relationships. To have a relationship to God is central to why we are here. And the relationship with God requires that we be similar to God. You cannot have a pleasurable relationship, or rather you can, but the deeper the compatibility, the deeper you have stuff in common, then the deeper and the more pleasurable the relationship. So therefore, in order to have the relationship with God, requires that the person becomes similar to God, so that you can enjoy the relationship. What I mean by that is, if you take everything you love, everything you admire, everything you honor, everything you respect, everything you think is good, etc., all rolled into one, that's what it means, that's what God... I mean, God is... That's only a fraction of what actually it means to have a relationship with God. Having a relationship with God is way, way beyond that idea. So therefore, to have that relationship, though, requires that you be similar to God, compatible to God. Right? And just to give you the example... Coca-Cola had a competition. You look at the Coke cap. I mean, it's this human instinct to look at the bottle cap, right? I know people who most of their higher education actually comes from Snapple, right? That's basically, right? They have a master's in Snapple. They look at that. Oh yeah, really? That's the extent of the reading they do as well. Exactly, right? So now Coca-Cola had a competition. You open the Coke cap, and it says either the winning word or it says try again. I had a guy at my house once. He opens a Coke bottle, says, try again. So he closes it, then he opens it. He says, like, dude, this is not working, you know. So anyway, Californian college student. Anyway, so winning prize at the time was you got to spend a week together with the Beastie Boys. The Beastie Boys are purported to be a singing group, right? Whether they produce music or not is open to question. But in any case, right, the first prize was you got to spend 1 week with the Beastie Boys. You could actually spend time with them backstage and serve them drinks and no doubt other pharmaceuticals. And this was first prize in the competition. And I was thinking to myself that at the time, in Newark, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra was playing. Famous Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Herbert von Karajan, great German conductor. He is an expert in Beethoven. I actually have a set of 6 CDs of Herbert von Karajan. I play them really loud in the car. I get the great pleasure of coming home at night and someone in a pimped out Subaru next to me, right, with Snoop Dogg playing extremely loud, begs me to turn down the Beethoven so I can hear the rap, right? It's what we call revenge of the nerds. So anyway, I'm imagining that Herbert von Karajan finishes conducting the concert. Goose steps backstage to the Coke machine, feeds in some Deutschmarks or Euros, whatever the Nazis, Germans use now. And basically he gets a Coke and he opens the Coke and he sees, so, I have won the competition. Let me ask you something. Would it be first prize for Herbert von Karajan to spend a week with the Beastie Boys, or would it be a condemnation to the depths of hell? The answer is B. It's condemnation to the depths of hell, because there is no compatibility. For us to have the pleasure of the relationship with God requires compatibility. So the third purpose of the commandments is compatibility, similarity. Number four, I picked up in Santa Barbara. I was speaking in Hillel at the University of California in Santa Barbara to a group of college students there. It was... They're very laid back, very laid back, and speaking to them was like a near-death experience. They managed to sit on chairs like this and be almost completely horizontal. I do not know how they do it, right? But they can sit in a chair, and you can see this like room of people horizontal, right? And it's an amazing thing, right? So and all you hear from the room is like, "Dude, party, chill," right? Those are the only three words you hear, like, "Dude, party." Chilled. Right, anyway, so I tried to make contact with one of them and schmooze. So I said, excuse me? He says, dude. I said, your name is dude? He said, dude? I said, oh, okay. So anyway, dude. And he says, yeah. And I say, so what are you majoring in? He says, I said, no, precisely, please. He said, dude? I said, no, you're dude. He says, like, anyway, I say, okay, fine. So I say, what are you majoring in? He says, like, something between religion and philosophy. I said, could you be more precise? He said, sure. I say, go ahead, dude. And he says, yeah, I'm majoring in revelation. He's majoring in revelation. I have a strong feeling that that's part of an organic chemistry study with him. But in any case, he's majoring in Revelation. And I thought to myself, I went to a Hasidic high school. I am Hasidic. I know I don't look it, but I'm Reform Hasidic. Anyway, what someone who's really Hasidic calls me basic. But in any case, right, as opposed to Hasidic, doesn't matter. Okay, so anyway, and they used to tell us that the Baal Shem Tov, founder of the Hasidic movement, used to say that anything you experience, you're supposed to learn from. So I thought to myself, if the Baal Shem Tov was with me in Santa Barbara, what would he have learnt from the dude? And I thought to myself, it's actually a Zohar. The Zohar says that the Zohar says that every one of us is supposed to be majoring in revelation. Our purpose on this world is revelation. What do I mean by revelation? To reveal the godliness in the world. To reveal the godliness inside of us and to reveal the godliness in the world. Everything you do is either going to conceal God or it's going to reveal God. So actually, any way you act, if I act in one way, I am revealing the godliness in the human being. I act in another way, I am concealing the godliness of the human being. If I am selfish, if I am egotistical, if I am insensitive, if I am etc., right, then basically I am concealing the soul within me. If I act in an altruistic, kind, good fashion, then I am revealing God within me. So everyone is either revealing or concealing. That is basically where we stand balanced between those two things. And the mitzvot are designed to do the act of revelation. The way I look at someone is also either revelation or concealment, right? The way I look at myself is either revelation or concealment. So that is the fourth idea. Number five, the purpose of the mitzvot also is to take concepts and materialize them into formats that will be something that we can deal with. That is to say, as human beings, we operate through action. So let's say God would have told us thousands of years ago, I want you to take a week of the year and think about the Exodus from Egypt. How many people do you think today would know about the Exodus? I'd say probably zero. Because just thinking about it is not going to do anything. But the Torah says, eat matzah and sit around a table and talk about it and drink some four cups of wine and have bitter herbs, maror, and have lamb on the plate and so on and so forth. When you do these things, then basically you are integrating the idea into yourself through physical actions. So we believe that the house is a holy space. We believe that your home is a holy space. How do you show that it's holy? So one of the ways we express that is we have words of Torah on the doorpost of our home, called a mezuzah. It's a way of saying that this is a holy, sacred space. So everything we do is either revelation, is bringing down the Torah into a physical format. It's actually like art. In art, an artist takes a concept and then puts the concept into a physical form, like a painting or a sculpture or something like that. They take the concept and put it into a physical form. And now when it's in the physical form, you can deal with it. You can look at it and you can think about it and it can have a greater impact on you than if it's just a concept. So it's a very, very important idea. We call it Ner Mitzvah, the Torah, or the Mitzvah is like a candle and the Torah is light. Meaning that a candle, which is a physical thing, is something which contains light. Light is almost complete, is almost beyond the physical world, right? So, but all you need to produce light is a very simple thing, paraffin wax and a string, and you've got it, it's a candle, right? And that's an amazing analogy, because that's what the mitzvot are. Simple physical things, but the simple physical things can also reveal very amazing truths and ideas about the world. So we have five ideas behind the commandments. Number one is refinement of the person to enhance my relationship with others, with God and with myself. Number two is reflection, to think about things versus reflex, not thinking, to exercise the muscle of free will. Number three is to create a similarity and relationship with God. Number four is revelation of the true nature of the human being, the true nature of the world. And number five is encapsulation of truths in physical forms. Okay. So that's the purpose of the commandments. Now we could ask ourselves, how do they work? Why are the details so important? How do the details do this? So the there's a few answers to this, but let me start with an analogy. I'm afraid you're going to actually have to think about this one. I'm sorry about that. I know it's late at night and it's difficult, right? But nevertheless, let's exert ourselves a little bit, right? What we're going to do is, I want to take, in order to be good in any system, you have to have two things. What are the two things you need to be good in any system of morals? Okay. You need commitment. You need to be committed. And you need consistency. In other words, you need to be committed. He's a rabbi, doesn't count. You need to be committed.
He's a young rabbi.
Right, still. Right? You need to be committed to the ideal, to the moral, and you also need to act consistently with that commitment. Example, is it possible to be consistent without being committed? Sure. For example, many people, people in Saudi Arabia don't shoplift. That's not because they're committed to honesty. That's because they're committed to having their hands on the end of their arms, right? That's not a commitment to, it doesn't mean a person's good, it just means he's smart, right? Or for example, in Singapore, very clean, the traffic flows very smoothly, people don't jaywalk, there's not a lot of litter or graffiti. Why is that? Because if you would litter or do graffiti or jaywalk or speed, you get an on-the-spot fine or you go to jail, right? Very authoritarian, right? So it could be a person's acting consistently with good ideals, but they're not really committed to them. What about the other way around? You can be committed and not consistent. I would say that's the most common problem that we have, meaning that most of us, if we'd examine our basic commitments in morality, they're probably very similar. The difference is how far we go in being consistent with those commitments. You understand? So it's very important to be consistent. The example, the principal phones home from school. He says, Mr. Smith, your son is being suspended. So Mr. Smith says, from where? He says, no, he's being sent home from school. He says, I see. Why is he being sent home from school? He says, your son was caught cheating on an exam. So Mr. Smith says, my son? Cheating? Impossible. My son is such a good boy, and he's so brilliant that he'd never cheat on an exam. So the principal says, I have evidence that your son was cheating. He says, what's the evidence? He says, your son and the boy next to him had exactly the same answers in the exam. So what does Mr. Smith say? The boy sitting next to my son, the son of Satan sitting next to my boy, he copied from my son. Send him home. My son is righteous. So the principal says, we have further evidence. He says, what's your evidence? He says, question number 19, the boy sitting next to your son wrote, I don't know. Question number 19, your son wrote, I don't know either. He says, so it would appear to me that your son is neither so brilliant nor is he so pious. So the father, the kid gets sent home and the father takes the kid to the study and he says, get in the study. The kid says, anything but the study. He says, get in the study. So he says, turn off your iPod, turn off your cell phone, turn off your pager, turn off your BlackBerry. Okay, it's all off. The kid's now unwired and he's in his listening mode. Right, and the father now gives him one of the parental lectures, number 8, right, which is on honesty and truth and etc. And he's giving the kid the lecture on honesty. In the middle of the lecture on honesty, the phone rings. Mr. Smith answers the phone. She says, hello, Mr. Cohen, how are you? Mr. Smith says, no, I'm sorry, he's not home at the moment. Can he get you a cell phone? Oh yes, he's overseas. Yes, not available on the cell phone. Yes, bye, click. And he carries on with the honesty lecture. Does Mr. Smith believe that it's wrong to cheat on an exam? I think he believes that. Is he committed to the idea of honesty and truth? I think so. Is he consistent? Not when Cohen's on the phone, right? So he's not consistent. Very difficult. And obviously, this is not going to do much good for the education of the child, as you can imagine, right? The lecture about honesty is not backed up by action. The kid's going to just, type like the same kid, the principal phones a year later, and he says, Mr. Smith, you better come to school. This might be a police matter. I don't want to talk about it on the phone. He says, oh my God. He says, what is it? He says, come to school. So he comes to school. The kid's sitting in front of the principal. He says, what is it? Principal says, your son has been stealing office supplies from the school for the past year. His father looks at the kid and says, is this true? Kid says, yeah, it's true. The father says, I don't understand it. You need office supplies? Tell me, I'll bring them home from work. So clearly, right, consistency is important not only for education, but consistency is also important to be good. So in order to be good, you need to be both committed to the good ideals, and you also have to be consistent, act consistently with them. So now, let me play a little mental exercise here. What we're going to do is we're going to take one commitment, one moral commitment, which I don't you don't necessarily have to agree with it, we're just going to pretend that we agree with it, and we're going to see how easy it is to be consistent with that one commitment, okay? That's what we're going to do, mental exercise here. The commitment that I have chosen is the following. As of tomorrow morning, we are committed to the idea that animals should not suffer for humans, and therefore we will not benefit from the suffering of an animal. Does that sound like an easy commitment? That sounds fairly... Don't go hunting tomorrow, right? That'll be number one. Okay, but let's try and start earlier than that. Okay, animals should not suffer for humans. I will not benefit from the suffering of animals. So you wake up in the morning. What's the first decision you have to make relevant to this commitment?
Veggie.
First commitment?
Go vegetarian.
No, you wake up in the morning and say, oh, I better not have steak. First thing you do? Oh my gosh. Right? A man after my own heart. But I mean, no, that's the first thing you have to, first decision you have to make.
Shoes.
Before you put on your shoes. What are you, in the army?
Brush your teeth.
Brush your teeth. The first thing you have to do is, you worry, should I use Colgate? Doesn't Colgate test their toothpaste on rabbits? Right? Don't they have some plant in Colgate in Pennsylvania with the rabbits, you know, duct taped to a lab bench with some machine doing this for like weeks at a time, see how long it takes the rabbit to die of an overdose of Colgate toothpaste, right? Cosmetics, right? They've got these rabbits sitting there like that with their eyes open. They stick stuff in there, you know, the eyeshadow and eyeliner, right? They feed lipstick to guinea pigs and stuff like that. Here, have some more, right, etc., right? Whatever, I don't know if they actually do this, but that's more or less, let's say it. Right, so now, would you use the toothpaste? What do you think? Would you use it?
No.
Were you scared to commit yourselves? This is the end of your exam will not be dependent upon this question. Right, if that's true, they test the toothpaste on animals, would you use the toothpaste?
You're not supposed to, no.
Well, if your commitment is that animals shouldn't suffer for you and you won't benefit, of course you shouldn't use... So you decide, look, I don't know if they test these deodorants and stuff. So no toothpaste, no deodorant, no aftershave, no shampoo. So you're not smelling great and your mouth is still like upholstered from last night, which like doesn't feel very good, right? And also, now, okay, so stage two. What about clothing? Should you wear leather? I don't think so. Did the animal volunteer its leather? Look, they're going to eat me anyway. May as well take my skin. I mean, no, right? The animal did not do it voluntarily, so therefore no leather shoes. So you're wearing uncomfortable shoes, not leather. No belts. You have to hold up your pants, right? How about wool? You think it's okay to wear wool? I mean, a sheep doesn't die when you take the wool. But on the other hand, was there informed consent? Anyone ask the sheep if it wanted to be shorn? Right, the sheep's walking along. Some Australian guy called Bruce grabs it. He says, "Come here, mate." Grabs the sheep. Has these huge clippers. Right, etc. It hurts the sheep. The sheep walks out there, totally shorn. Right, it's got a piece of toilet paper all over it. Right, because you know it actually can, they get nicks from when they do that. Right, and everyone walks out, and the rest of the flock say, "You got shorn." Right, etc. So now, so no wool. So you wear polyester clothing. You've got uncomfortable shoes on, you're holding up your pants, and you don't smell very good. Right? So I guess if you'd meet an animal, it'll be safe. Humans, you'd probably kill. Right? So now, the next decision you have to make is food. So you go to you decide to skip breakfast because this is too complicated, it's too early in the morning. So you go to a restaurant, and you ask the waiter comes over, he says, "Hi, my name's Gordon, I'll be your waiter for this evening." And I say, "Hi, Gordon." And I say, "What's good?" And Gordon says, "Oh, the steak is awesome." I say, listen, Gordon, I don't really want steak because I don't think animals should suffer for humans, therefore I'm not going to eat steak. So he says, "Oh, you don't understand." He says, "All the meat in our restaurant comes from the Happy Valley Ranch." I said, "The Happy Valley Ranch?" Gordon says, "Yeah, it's a Happy Valley Ranch." He pulls a piece of paper out of his pocket and he reads, "In the Happy Valley Ranch," music starts in the background, "all the cows are allowed to roam free wherever they want. There's no barbed wire or electric fences. They can eat all manner of herbs and grasses, both legal and otherwise. The cows drink only Fijian spring water and Foster's lager beer. They get a shiatsu massage every day and they have aromatherapy every evening." He says, "These cows are the happiest animals in the world. Every now and again, tragically, one of them dies. So we cut it up and make steaks out of it. These steaks are kosher for vegetarians. You can eat this steak with a clear conscience," Gordon tells me. What would you say? Assuming Gordon is not lying, would it be okay to eat those steaks? How about having a barbecue with those steaks? Is it important what the other people think? Is that a moral issue? If your neighbour thinks you're a flaming hypocrite, is it going to make your program effective? Of course not. Right? He says, Becker's preaching about animals not suffering for humans. He's got a steak on the barbie. Right? So I go and tell him, you don't understand, the steak's from the Happy Valley Ranch. And he says, the Happy Valley, I've never heard of that. And even if I convince my neighbour, what about a person walking by? They smell a barbecue. You smell a barbecue. What do you say to yourself? Oh, I've got to have some fermented tofu. Generally not. Right? I need some nori, some seaweed. No, you'd say you smell barbecue. You want a steak. You want to slaughter an animal and eat it. Right? So basically, right, I have to take that into account in terms of my commitment. It's not a detail which is too small. I think it's a very important detail. So I decide I will skip those steaks because it's too complex. I go to the supermarket and get some dairy food. I figure, what could be wrong with dairy food? Yogurt, ice cream, cheese, milk, etc. Is there any cruelty involved in that? Did an animal suffer to produce milk? I don't think so. I mean, if the animal doesn't get milked, it's in pain. So therefore, I feel good about having milk. And then some guy tells me, a PETA activist is standing there protesting outside the milk department, and he says, you're drinking milk? That's cruel. I say, why is it cruel? He says, well, what about cows in the wild? Wild cows, never heard of. But he says, what about cows in the wild? What happens to their milk? I said, I don't know. He says, I'll tell you what happens. The cow has a baby, a calf. The calf nurses from the mother. When the calf finishes nursing from the mother stops producing milk. End of story. He says, the only reason you've got so many dairy products is because you know where the baby calf is? No, he says, over there in the veal section of the freezer. So he says, if you think you're being a good boy by having milk, think again. So is he right? I mean, let's face it. The cows are in captivity. They are exploited, right? They are given hormones so they can produce more milk. Their child is taken away from them and slaughtered for veal, right? And basically, you've got your milk. So I don't want to turn anyone off meat. I'm just pointing out here that are these details too small to take into account, or are they important? If you want to be consistent with your principle, these details are important. So I'm going to end the analogy here because I see it's a little bit of an effort to follow. But okay, right, but it's a heavy meal after the fast, whatever, I don't know. Right, but again, I'm going to end the analogy here because the idea, I think, is the following. The Jewish people, the Talmud, Jewish law, etc., is the ultimate guide to consistency, meaning we've been given principles on Sinai. Principles, right? And the principles, it is not, if you believe in those principles, you have to follow it all the way down. Right, you've got to be consistent. How can millions of people over thousands of years in hundreds of countries be consistent? The answer is you need a Talmud, you need Jewish law. That's what Jewish law is about. It's not nitpicking. It's not obsessive compulsive. What it's trying to do is help us be consistent with principles. Let's example, right? I'm sure everyone here believes that it's wrong to steal. Theft is wrong. However, how do you define theft? Let's say I'm at work and I'm playing computer games during the time I'm supposed to be working. Is that theft? Yeah, that's theft, right? Or if someone lends me a book, and then someone else asks if I can borrow the book, and I say, sure, just give it back to me because I need to give it back to so-and-so. Is that theft? Could be. Because the guy may trust you as far as your care for books, but he may not trust your character assessment, right? I mean, maybe he doesn't trust you as for lending it out. He doesn't give you permission to do that. It could be it's a form of theft. So there's many different types of theft. So in other words, if you are concerned with that principle, you've got to be concerned with the details as well as the principle itself. So therefore, the Torah is the ultimate guide to consistency. That is number one. Number two in terms of methodology is that the action affects the inner person. What I mean by that is every action you do affects who you are. You actually mold your inner self through your external actions. The inner self is affected by the external. Let's say you want to become generous. You'd like to become a giver. How do you become a giver? Do you read biographies of Maria Teresa? Right? Do you sit there and meditate and say, give, give, give? How do you actually become a giver? Any ideas here?
Start
giving, precisely, correct, sir. Right, you start giving. It's the act of giving that helps you become more of a giver. Every action you do affects the person you are. Kashrut, for example. The idea of kashrut is very much about self-control. I walk by a store and I'm hungry, and I say, Mordechai, hungry. Mordechai, eat. I walk into the store and just eat. Right? Or, right, I look at the store and say, is it kosher? Is it not kosher? I look at the food, meat, milk, what blessing. In other words, there's levels at which I am holding myself back. Right? Self-control. I remember I was at a, you've probably been in this, I don't know if you've been in this scenario or not, but you're going shopping with a little kid at a food store right after school. This is not a good, it's not a good idea. Right? The kid's all antsy from the day. They're hungry. You're frustrated, right? And they're standing there. So, you know, it happens. You get to the line. You go into the, you know, 10 items or less line. And the person in front of you does not use a base 10 system, right? And has 65 items, right? And she is trying to pay with a third-party trek from Guatemala, right? And take care of a mortgage as well. Plus, and it's made out in Thai baht, right? And so on and so forth. And then, you know, as she is trying to, and she's using coupons from the store that was here three hostile takeovers ago, right? And she's arguing, and then finally, and your kid's standing there saying, I'm hungry, and they're fetching, et cetera, et cetera. And they're surrounded on both sides by a 6 foot high wall of candy. And they're stuck there, and you're stuck with them. And then finally it gets to your turn and it runs out of ribbon in the machine. And then the checkout girl gets her nose ring caught in the mechanism when she's changing. They have to bring in the jaws of life and the EMTs, et cetera, et cetera. It's horrific. And all the time the kid's saying, can I have one of those? Can I have one of those? He's like, no! Right? It'll spoil your supper. And the kid says, if you don't get me one of those chocolate bars, I'm going to throw myself on the floor and have a tantrum and kick and scream and go hysterical. You will become so frustrated and angry and upset that you'll eventually hit me. Someone's then going to call a social worker. There'll be lawyers, they'll involve, there'll be the police here. Is it worth it? Just 25 cents for the chocolate bar and you can avoid all these legal hassles. My kid does this all the time. So anyway, so I'm in this scenario. I'm standing at a store. It was in Toronto. And we're in more or less this scenario, waiting in line with the kid and getting very frustrated. And the kid says, may I please have that chocolate bar? Now, the fact that he said may and he said please just melted me. I couldn't say. I said, oh, let me have a look. Right? So I look at it to check if it's kosher. And I said to him, Avram Shimon, it's not kosher. He was 5 at the time. And his reaction when I said it's not kosher was, oh, okay. Is there something kosher? I said, let's have a look. And I thought to myself, amazing. My 5-year-old has got more self-control than most adults in the Western world. You tell an adult in the Western world, no. What do they think that means? They think that means not now. They think that means don't get caught. They think that means be safe. They think that means don't get addicted. They think that, but the idea, no, is not in the vocabulary. I was once talking to someone on the plane I said a blessing on my coffee and she looked at me and she says, excuse me, do you always talk to your food before you eat it? And I said, actually, I was talking to God, not the food. Right? And anyway, we got into a discussion about kosher. And she says, you're traveling, why don't you just eat whatever there is? I said, no, I always eat kosher. She said, what do you mean, always? I said, no, I always eat kosher. She said, always? I said, yeah. She said, what if there's no kosher food available? I said, I'll be hungry a little bit, you know what I mean? I'll get fruit, vegetables. She said, what if it's life and death? I said, life and death's a different scenario. Life and death, I'm allowed to eat non-kosher. But I said, it's not, most situations are not life and death, right? So I said, I'm committed to that. She didn't really understand the idea that I absolutely always do this. The idea that a person will know is just not most people's vocabulary. It's unbelievable. But that's what kashrut is about. There's a lot of aspects of the Torah which train us in certain areas of self-control. So it's the action that affects the inner person. You know, the way you dress affects how you look about, how you feel about yourself. I remember when I used to be I was in the Israeli army, I used to get into the reserve duty. And so when I'd be called up for reserves, put on my uniform. As I'm putting on the uniform, the big boots, you know, and the army stuff and the big belt and everything, I could feel myself expanding, right? You know, the muscles growing. I just like felt myself transforming into Rabbi Rambo, you know? By the time I got to the base and they gave me the gun, I'm standing there saying, which way is Syria? Right? And they'd say, aren't you the chaplain, sir? And I said, oh, sorry, you're right. Right? But I mean, it has an impact, right? Everything you do has an impact on how you feel about yourself, on everything else. So it's the action affects the inner person. Number 3, it's to make one aware. The mitzvot are continual reminders that there's a spiritual side to life. Meaning that I don't just, instead of just eating, you know, we actually stop and contemplate for a second. Actually, on another plane flight from Detroit to Seattle, there's a very small plane. You know the small commercial planes, but really small, right? Some of them are like 40 seaters. That's okay. You know, one aisle here and then 2 seats. Then you got these planes which are much smaller. I was in, I forgot where I was going, but it was a very, Detroit to Seattle. It was a very small plane. And one of these planes, they asked people to volunteer to move to different parts of the plane for the weight distribution. That gets me very nervous. Like, what if I, what if I want to get up and go to the bathroom? They go, get out of the bathroom, we're going down! I mean, there were two people, they asked for two people to move to the back. So it was myself and a priest moved to the back, right? The two clergy people, right? So we both moved to the back. We're sitting near each other. And they brought me, my ears had not adjusted to the volume. We went up to cruising altitude. I couldn't hear a darn thing. They bring me my kosher food. They always bring kosher food first in order to exacerbate anti-Semitism. So anyway, I get the kosher food first. And I managed to get through the three layers of Kevlar surrounding it, managed for the gravy managed to spurt right there, exactly there. Like, just even when I button it, there's gravy right there. It's like unbelievable. It's like a homing device, right? That type of thing. Anyway, and an amazing thing, Also, it gives you strength of faith because the sages tell us that the plague in Egypt of hail was actually fire and ice together. And whenever I get kosher food on a plane, I just feel like a tremendous uplift of my faith. Because here, right in front of me, half the tray is as hot as the surface of the sun. You touch it with your finger, it'll get burnt to a stump. Right? And the other half looks like frozen wastes from a South Pole expedition. It is like unbelievable. And it's in the same tray. I mean, I don't know. According to physics, I don't know how this works. I'm not an expert in thermodynamics, but to me, this seems to be problematic. In any case, right, I get the food. And after snapping the fork and now trying to eat the thing with a spoon, right? And I say a brocha, a blessing. I say bor, and I say it at about this level of volume because I couldn't hear. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nehiyeh Bedvaro. That's the blessing you make on unidentifiable food, right? So I say this brocha and I start chewing, and when I chew, I can start hearing, my ear pops, and the priest says to me, "Excuse me." I said, I didn't say anything. And he says, "You actually said something rather loud." I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, you're right. So I wasn't talking to you." He says, "There's no one else here." "Who were you talking to?" I said, "I was talking to God." He said, "Oh, okay, I can hear that." Right? So he said, "What'd you say to him?" So I said, "You, God, who is the source, with whom I have a personal relationship, Ata, Hashem, God, Elokeinu, our God, with whom we have a national relationship. Melech Ha'olam, King of the world, with whom we have a relationship just because we're creations. Right? Baruch, you are the source of everything, the pool from which everything flows. Shakol, and that everything, Nehiyeh Bedvaro, was created just by your word." And he said, "That's a beautiful blessing." I said, "Isn't it?" Right? And it is a beautiful thing. But you see, part of the idea is to make ourselves aware when I walk out of a door of the house, and I touch the mezuzah. Right? You don't have to kiss it. You just touch it. Right? You can just look at it. Or you can blow it a kiss. Right? Et cetera. Right? Less wear and tear on the mezuzah. You know what I'm saying? Right? So you just touch the mezuzah. But it gives you an idea. You at least stop for a moment and think about God and his presence in the world and our relationship and how I deal with other people and so on and so forth. Everything we do is a way of making us aware of the spiritual side of life, slowing us down for a second. Slowing us down. By the way, that's what Shabbos is about to a great degree. Shabbat, is about the idea of stop and think and appreciate things and exist as opposed to do. You don't have time to exist. And then, finally, I would say the idea of the commandments is that they are obligation as opposed to rights, meaning they are ways to make us aware of our obligations and not just think of our rights. Because we very often, at least in the Western world, the Western legal system is heavily based on rights. Whereas in Judaism, it's based on obligations. There's a big difference between those two. I'll give you a story that will show you how that works. There's a midrash in Parshat Noach, which has the following story. Alexander of Macedon was visiting an African country. And he's sitting where the king, and a court case comes before the king. Kings in ancient times used to be like judges as well. They used to judge court cases. Case comes before the king. One guy says, "I bought a field from that man." He says, I was ploughing the field, my plough hit something. Right, and I dig it up, it's a box of jewellery. So I say, I bought a field, I did not buy jewellery, the jewellery belongs to him. Alexander is like, what the? What? I mean, can you imagine? Anyone here a lawyer? You ever had a case like that? Right, so then, the other guy says, oh no, I signed a contract that said that I'm selling you the land and everything in it. So the jewellery belongs to you. Each one is saying the jewellery belongs to the other guy. Alexander cannot believe this. Right, I mean, he's downing daiquiris one after the other. So anyway, the African king says to one guy, how old is your oldest unmarried child? He says, I've got a son of 21. He says to the other guy, how about you? He says, I've got a daughter of 19. The king says, right, by virtue of the power invested in me by me, I hereby declare them engaged. And the money that you found in the field, the jewellery, will go to their wedding. And everyone says, mazel tov, everyone's happy. I don't know about the kids, who cares? Parents are happy, that's the main thing, obviously. Right, so anyway, they leave, and then Alexander is sitting there, he can't believe what's happening here. And the king looks at him, and he says, what's the problem? Alexander says, this would never happen in my country. So the king says, if it did, how would you have ruled? Alexander says, I'm telling you, it would never happen. The guy would find the money, he'd run, that would be it, end of story. He says, if it did, how would you rule? Alexander says, obvious. I'd kill them both and take the money for the treasury. Like, duh. So now the African king is in a state of shock. He says to Alexander, does it rain where you live? He says, yes. Does the sun rise every day? He says, yes. He says, He says, do you have animals where you live? Alexander says, yeah. He says, I understand. It must be in the merit of the animals that the sun rises and the rain comes down, because the humans where you live clearly don't deserve it. That's the end of the Midrash. Beautiful story, I think, and it represents a very beautiful idea. Professor Susan Last Stone of Harvard, in an article in the Harvard Law Review, says that she sees in this Midrash an example of two different schools, two different ways of looking at the world. In Alexander of Macedon, the Greek world, and we in the Western world are children of the Greeks, right? Looked at the world in terms of rights. I found something in my field, it's my right to get it, to keep it. The other guy is thinking, I left something in my field, it's my right to get it back. And the king is thinking, I'm the king, it's my right to do anything the hell I want. Right? The other way, however, in this African country, which represents Jewish law as well, is very different. It's saying, I found something in my field, it's my obligation to find the rightful owner. The other guy says, I signed a contract, it's my obligation to carry out the terms of the contract. The king is saying, it's my obligation to make my subjects happy, how can I best do that? So when you have a rights type of system, what's the focus on?
Me.
No. It's on what can I get, what do I deserve, what am I owed, what can you do for me? In a system based on chiyuv, on obligation, what is the focus? What can I do for you? What do I owe? Right. Where, in other words, think of a marriage where each one, the husband and wife, are only thinking about their rights. What type of marriage will it be?
Very bad.
Very bad, exactly. It'll be like Groucho Marx, who said he was happily married for 2 years. Unfortunately, he's been married for 20. Right? So it's that type of marriage, very bad. Right? However, in a marriage in which both the husband and wife are focused on their obligations, that's a recipe for a happy marriage. What about a city where people are thinking about their obligations, not their rights? What about a country? What about a world? Right? Totally different. Totally, totally different. So the abundance of mitzvot is there to focus us not on our rights, but to focus us on our obligations. As John F. Kennedy said in his inaugural speech, he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. So what the mitzvot say is, ask not what others can do for you, ask what you can do for others. So that's some of the introduction to the details, the idea of the commandments, consistency and commitment, number one. Number two is action creates the inner person. Number three is awareness of the spiritual side of life, time to think, stop and think. And number four is the idea of rights or obligations versus rights. That's a little bit of an introduction to the 613 commandments. The rest is commentary. Go and learn. Thank you very much for listening. Happy to take questions. If anyone wants also, I didn't have a chance to unpack, but if anyone, I have a book which I wrote, which is The Philosophy of Judaism and the Laws of Judaism Altogether. I wouldn't say you should chuck out the rest of your library, but it's pretty obsolete, you know, once you have this. So if anyone's interested, called Gateway to Judaism, so keep your Bible, but everything else. Anyway, so that's, I'll be selling that afterwards. Thank you very much. See you.